Coming up on Tech News Weekly, iFixit tore apart the Galaxy Fold before Samsung took it back. Google walkout organizers say the company has been retaliating against them. Nest cams are apparently easy targets for hackers, and that's all thanks to users' poor password habits. And we take a look at the Apple Qualcomm trial. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 80, recorded Thursday, April 25th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Behind the Tech, a podcast with Microsoft CTO Kevin Scott. He talks with tech heroes, interesting people, and folks who have made our modern world possible. Subscribe to Behind the Tech where you listen to your podcasts today.
And by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use invoicing and accounting software. If you don't believe us, try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW. Hello, welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. Breaking is right.
And then putting it back together.
And then putting it back together and then shipping it away.
Yes.
Samsung's Galaxy Fold just can't catch a break these days. As the devices sent to journalists to review are being called back for a multitude of reasons. Namely, the displays are flickering, the screen itself is being confused with a screen protector and being peeled off, debris is getting lodged in underneath the display, resulting in warping, all those things and more. The talented folks at iFixit have been patiently tearing down the device to get to the heart of what's behind all of this failure to begin with, and hopefully what could be done to maybe minimize failure in the future. I don't know, have some bright ideas for how we can do better. Joining us to talk about the iFixit teardown of the Galaxy Fold is Jeff Suovinen from iFixit. Welcome, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we appreciate you joining us. So, first of all, I mean, you guys, you know, you take part in a lot of different types of products. This seems to be pretty different from a lot of the other devices that you've pulled apart. What's so different under the hood? What are some of the kind of different changes that Samsung made here to allow for this kind of foldable design?
Yeah, it is different. I mean, yes and no. A lot of what we found was actually pretty standard, you know, smartphone Galaxy parts. But the batteries, the circuit boards, the cameras, those kinds of things looked pretty standard. I think for me, there were two big things that stood out. One is obviously that flexible OLED panel, which is just really interesting to see in person. And then the hinge system is just fascinating because mechanical moving parts in particular just isn't something that we see much on smartphones. You might have a couple of mechanical buttons and a vibrator motor, which you never see because it's buried inside the phone. But mechanical parts are a big potential point of failure. And we've seen manufacturers trying to eliminate those. Apple, for example, switched to a solid state home button that doesn't physically click. Their track pads don't physically click anymore, although they're very good at fooling you into thinking that they do. And so this huge hinge system is a big move away from that trend. And then obviously the OLED panel, the flexible panel is very interesting. Just the fact that it's soft and it folds is something we're not used to. Smartphones, you know, they're all covered in Gorilla Glass and they're virtually scratch proof now. So this was something different.
Can you understand why some reviewers took a look at this and started peeling off that plastic layer? Like, I mean, you actually had to kind of peel off some of these layers because that's part of breaking it apart. But as you were doing so, did it kind of make sense why people might think that that's removable? And do you envision other people, like regular people, thinking the same thing?
Absolutely, 100%. And you know, just thinking back to the most recent Samsung teardown that we did prior to this was the Galaxy S10 and the S10e. All of those S10 phones shipped with a screen protector right from the factory. When we were setting up for our teardown, one of the very first things I did was rip that off because it was gathering up dust and looking ugly in photos. And I thought, this looks terrible. I got to get rid of this. The Galaxy Fold looks like the same thing. It looks like it's got this thin little screen protector that would just be so easy to slide a fingernail under there and pull it off. I don't blame anybody for having done that. It seems like an obvious thing to try.
Hmm. So the phone is not coming out on Friday as planned. Was there anything inside that you could think that could be fixed so that it would come out at all? Or do you think that this is sort of a lost cause in general?
It's a fascinating question. It's so close to launch. I have to assume they had tens, if not hundreds of thousands of these manufactured and ready to go. Mm-hmm. I certainly can't imagine they'll be able to physically alter the hardware in the kind of time frame that, you know, that people are probably hoping for, you know, next month or June or whatever. Maybe they'll find a way to stick a Band-Aid on it or include more warnings about, you know, what not to do and how careful you have to be. I could also frankly see them just, like you said, canceling or postponing it indefinitely while they sort it out.
I mean, it's a really difficult spot for Samsung to be in, right? Like brand new kind of device category, supposedly paving the way for this new future of foldable devices, and this being the shining example, Samsung would be the company to do it and to do it right. But I mean, right out of the gate before it's ever released, all this stuff happening. One of the big reasons, of course, is that particles seem to be able to get in underneath the display. So even with the hinge system and kind of the plastic trim that surrounds the display, right at the point of the hinge, the plastic can't quite go there because the plastic is not bendy, right? It needs to have that room for things to bend. And when you do that, there's that point of ingress. There's that small, you know, slightly open hole that, who knows, if you're keeping this in your pocket, you're going to have pocket lint fly in there at some point. It's a really big risk for Samsung. That right there, that hinge that you kind of see, that seems like one of the bigger problems here is that how do you even fix that? I don't even know. And that's going to be the challenge that Samsung's going to run into. Is that what kind of struck you guys in taking a look at that? Like, I don't even know where we go with this.
Yeah, I think we agree. There's been a lot of folks who have suggested that, you know, that gap at the bottom of the screen should be sealed with, you know, some sort of mesh or something. I can't help but feel like if it were easy to do that, why wouldn't they have done it already? Yeah. I can't imagine that didn't occur to them. You know, so it's easy to be a critic and say, oh, this is a dumb design. But I mean, at the end of the day, Samsung has some very talented engineers. I have to assume that they did their best. And it just kind of seems like this thing just went to market before it was ready and before all the problems could be solved.
You write in the teardown that the phone ships unfolded, but then the very first time you folded it, there's a noticeable crease. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, before we started taking it apart, we had a few minutes to unbox it and just kind of check it out. And it comes out of the box, you know, completely flat. And you know, we're kind of examining it in the light and looking at it. And it looked like a perfectly ordinary screen. Once we had folded it a few times, you could start to notice, if you're looking for it, that little crease. And I don't mean to overplay it, because I got to be honest, when we open this thing up, it is impressive out of the box. The screen is bright and vibrant. It just seems like something that shouldn't exist. It's a little bit sci-fi, you know, it's a really cool device. So even with the little crease there, yeah, you can see it if you're looking for it. I have a feeling that's sort of like the notch, you know, it's something you get used to and you don't really think about it too much. So that comment in the teardown was just an observation that, yeah, it ships completely flat and the fold does show up if you're looking for it after you fold it that initial time. Whoops, I just bumped my mic there. But I don't know how much of an issue. I think they have bigger issues to address than the crease. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, but the crease, noticing the crease front and center right after the first couple of folds, that worries me from a longevity standpoint. How much that crease intensifies over time potentially, and also like going back to that kind of point of ingress, you know, that at the fold itself, like if that increases over time, which we know it did at least within the first couple of folds, does that end up making like gaps like that even wider? And you know, I guess herein lies the big challenge of Samsung trying to pave the way with a new device category. It's probably hard to say with this device, but you know, this is kind of part of why you do what you do. How fixable is this device for the average everyday user? It sounds like it's probably near the bottom.
Yeah, so on every teardown, we evaluate the device for repairability. This didn't score well. We scored it a 2 out of 10. An argument could be made for a 3, but basically, you know, there's not a lot of concessions to repairability here. The covers are glued on, the batteries are glued down. It's repairable, but not easily. And you know, on an early, you know, first generation device, I really think of this as a prototype device. That's fairly common. It's disappointing to see, but I think repairability was not the primary, you know, challenge they were trying to solve here when they put this thing together.
Probably not.
At least it scored better than AirPods.
That's true.
This is true. It's not a sealed airtight capsule. Well, not airtight, but you know, it's more repairable than AirPods. That's just not saying much.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we love what you guys do at iFixit. I think the phone makers and other device makers, maybe not so much. You're not their biggest fans, or they're not your biggest fans. How did you get the device? Is what I want to ask.
We obtained it from a legitimate source who knew full well what we planned to do with it. Let's put it that way. I can't say too much more than that. I think the only point I want to emphasize is it didn't fall off the back of the proverbial truck, as some people have suggested. I understand why they think that, but no, that's not the case.
Okay, so it wasn't like an episode of The Sopranos or anything.
No, not at all.
Okay,
very. There was no drama in getting it. Let's put it that way.
But then you were also not on Samsung's list of approved reviewers necessarily.
We usually don't get review units. We're on good terms with most all of the major smartphone manufacturers. We have informal discussions. You know, I can't speak to any individual one, but they know who we are, and we know who a lot of their people are, and we're trying to be a positive influence, because repairability is something that just gets forgotten so much in product design these days. And, you know, that's bad for the consumer. It's bad for the environment. It's just a major bummer all around. And so we're trying to get more of them to think about repairability earlier in the design process.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to ask, although I think I really do know the answer to this, but it should be said, with the recall of all of these devices going back, you then had to let this go back to Samsung in pieces, right?
You know, we put it back together perfectly. I mean, it's not, we killed the display, unfortunately, but, you know, it didn't go back in pieces. It went back in one non-working piece, let's put it that way. But yeah, we did have to button it up and send it back when we were done.
And to be fair, sorry, go ahead.
Otherwise, I'd probably be here showing off the pieces for you, but yeah. I don't have them.
And many other tech reviewers sent theirs back, sent non-working devices also back this time.
Right.
So you're in good company.
This is true. Yeah, we're par for the course.
Jeff, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about iFixit's teardown of the Samsung Galaxy Phone, Galaxy Fold. Sorry, Jeff Suovinen from iFixit, and that's iFixit.com. Thank you so much, Jeff. We appreciate your time.
It was fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. Up next, is Google retaliating against employees who have voiced their disagreement with some of the company's more, let's say, contentious decisions? We're going to talk about that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Behind the Tech. It's a podcast from Microsoft. Chief Technology Officer Kevin Scott will take you behind the scenes with tech innovators, pioneers, and into the history of computing. Perfect for anyone who's a fan of Twit. In past episodes, he's talked to Andrew Ng, world-renowned for his insights into artificial intelligence. Of course, Danielle Feinberg, Pixar's computer scientist creating magic through lighting. There's Haran Lanier. Many people call him the father of VR, of virtual reality. On April 30th, they'll be chatting with Reid Hoffman. He's the investor, author, entrepreneur, and best known for co-founding LinkedIn. Hoffman is a partner at Greylock and author of the new book, Blitzscaling. On Behind the Tech, you're going to hear what inspired our podcast guests to author languages and build the tools that made an impact on the lives of developers and engineers today. Like I said, if you're a fan of the content here, you're going to love what you hear here. If you're early in your career, you're going to learn about the history of the tech industry. And if you're from Kevin's era, some of you may think, oh man, I remember that. You're going to identify with some of these stories. And of course, familiar names, Kevin Scott and Christina Warren hosting that podcast. Subscribe to Behind the Tech. Wherever you listen to your podcast, it's Behind the Tech. You can find it on Google Play Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Libsyn, all over the map, wherever you find podcasts. Sign up, tune in, and geek out at Behind the Tech. We thank them for sponsoring Tech News Weekly.
Late last year, seven Google employees organized the Google Walkout for Real Change. That was a company-wide protest to fight back against the way Google had handled sexual harassment and pay inequity at the company. Now Google is retaliating against two of those seven employees with demotions, requests for them to go on medical leave, and more. Natasha Tiku from Wired broke this story after Google employees shared an internal letter with them. Welcome to the show, Natasha.
Thanks for having me.
So give us an overview, a short overview of basically what the letter said.
Sure. So the letter was from Meredith Whitaker and Claire Stapleton, two of the organizers, and it was detailing retaliation that they have faced. In Claire's case, it was right after the walkout. In Meredith's case, I'm not sure if you're familiar with her work, but she's been extremely vocal in trying to raise attention around AI ethics, and including criticizing Google's ethics board that was recently disbanded. And so she said she faced retaliation shortly after the Ethics Council was, it crumbled in a matter of 7 days. So it was quick. But, at the top of the letter, it also says that several organizers have been facing retaliation. It just doesn't go into detail.
So and then Google responded right away to this letter. How did they respond?
Yeah, so they said, retaliation is prohibited. They investigate all claims. People are routinely given new assignments and rearrange based on business needs. And they said there was no retaliation.
So, yeah, and I find it interesting that they're saying, like, definitively, there was no retaliation yet. The organizers of all this are saying, well, we actually have a lot of incidents, a lot of situations. You know, I guess where I'm coming from when I read that was not that they hadn't discovered it, but that there emphatically is no retaliation, end of story. And I guess that just kind of struck me as kind of odd for them to make such a definitive statement when it's, I don't know, sometimes it's kind of murky. It's kind of difficult to understand even what retaliation might be in any given situation. Would you agree?
Yes, completely. And in Claire's case, she said that she got her demotion reversed after getting a lawyer. So, perhaps they investigated in that case. They didn't say anything to me about investigating Meredith's case. So I'm not sure where that definitive statement came from. And, this is a huge part of why it's so difficult for workers who are trying to enforce their labor protections. In an individual case, the company, if the company claims that it's part of a larger, some larger move, how do you disprove that? That's why class action suits are often the way that people are able to get companies to acknowledge things and make change. Mm-hmm.
So there were seven employees that organized the major organizers of the walkout. This is only two. Have you heard about other people being retaliated against, either organizers or people who just were part of the walkout?
Not walkout related in particular, but I know that activists and advocates within the company are fearful of retaliation, and they have had a change in the way, or, individuals have had a change in the way that management treats them. And, that's another instance where they don't give you a reason why things are different, and they always have like a kind of plausible deniability. But I think that not just within Google, but, we're all watching this labor movement form within tech and wondering, where is it going to go next? And what will the response from companies be?
Yeah, I think one thing that strikes me about retaliation just as like something that can happen against someone is there might be like something that's like an organized retaliation or something that's actually done with, in collaboration, people saying, all right, here's our strategy, here's what we do. And then there might also be employees within the company who are kind of acting on their own, who are saying, I know that this person who works underneath me did this thing, and I personally don't agree with it so much. So I'm going to start like cutting, I don't know if it's the this way at Google, but cutting back their hours or sending them on wild goose chases because that just makes me feel better as a person. How do you prove this? How do these charges that are kind of being talked about anyways, how is any of this proven when it's such a slow burn, under the radar sort of gaslighting approach? It's really difficult to prove.
Right. Well, In the description of Meredith's case, it did say that her role would change dramatically and she had to abandon her AI ethics work. So perhaps that refers to some emails. But part of the retaliation town hall that is happening on Friday is to hear other people's stories. And I imagine that would be a way to kind of discern if patterns emerge in the way that other people are being treated. That was one of the most powerful parts of the walkout. They had solicited, experiences from other Google employees that may have faced things similar to what was in the Andy Rubin article, or just, sexual harassment or discrimination in general. And I remember, reading about things that were said in Mountain View, and I thought it was this one woman, but it was somebody else. It's just the story sounded so similar. So perhaps that's a way, and I don't know, that they even need to prove it. Like, there's not a lawsuit in play or anything right now. So, perhaps just drawing attention to the issue could make some difference.
I mean, as you point out, this is really a labor issue. So it's different than what we've seen. It's different than one woman coming out and saying, I was sexually harassed, or someone, like you said, a lawsuit. It's different. This is a labor issue. They're being punished for organizing. Is there any, Google does not have a union. We're hearing a lot of union talk from, mostly journalists, but like a lot of more startup, younger companies. I mean, is that something that, that employees are talking about that you've heard, unionizing?
I think that tech employees have been, it's been a gradual process, right? To even kind of start to think of themselves as workers. The distinction between labor and management has really, come to the forefront over the past year. And, I think that as white collar workers who have a lot of job opportunities, they just haven't conceived of themselves in that way. And I think that, looking at traditional labor organizing tactics and rights and practices, like, for example, this would, I imagine, fall under protected concerted activity. And even just learning about that protection, as much as Google talks about transparency and a lot of tech companies talk about transparency, the kind of secrecy that existed for so long was also enforced by NDAs and, fear about breaking confidentiality. So it's been a learning process for everyone, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned the meeting that's happening tomorrow. Like, what do we know about that? It's just a kind of a coming together of, sharing stories, information. I imagine probably coming out of that meeting, we're probably going to hear in the public sphere a little bit more about other, stories that might be related to this. What do you know about that?
I know that I'm very curious. I think that it's very interesting that they're using the town hall format because, that is a classic Google kind of structure of communication. They host those TGIF all hands town halls and different kind of meetings. So I think it's very interesting for the employees to organize one for themselves. Mm-hmm. And it will be live streamed, so it won't just be one particular Google office. And I think I know that people in other offices are interested for sure.
So it'll be live streamed to only Google employees, not to,
everybody tune in and watch.
Natasha Tiku is a longtime tech reporter, currently senior writer at Wired covering Silicon Valley. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Even more reasons to turn on two-factor authentication coming up. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, accounting software that focuses on smart and informed decision-making, making it easy to shine a light on the health of your business. From kickoff to billing, FreshBooks supports your business every step of the way. And you can give them a try for free today. FreshBooks self-employed accounting software is ridiculously easy to use. You can create and customize invoices, log every hour with time tracking. They have easy to understand reports. They have payment scheduling. You can properly categorize expenses to make filing taxes a breeze. You've probably forgotten all about your taxes. Well, I've already done mine, but you're going to have to do them again next year. And if you struggled this year, then try out FreshBooks. As a hardworking small business owner, you're constantly evolving to keep up with your customer and industry demands. Let FreshBooks grow with you. No more digging out the checkbook. No more fumbling with paper invoices. Save a tree. Introducing automated clearinghouse ACH payments, aka bank transfers. ACH is a network that connects all financial institutions across the United States. With FreshBooks, you will get paid 2 times faster. It's ideal for large invoices, and they have a 1% transaction fee. That's very low. Keep your finger on the pulse of your small business wherever you are. You can use the FreshBooks mobile app, snap photos of your receipts, create and send invoices. You can chat with clients through the app. You can manage expenses super easy. Do not wait another day and join over 24 million people who have used FreshBooks. Visit FreshBooks.com/TNW. And don't forget to enter Tech News Weekly in that How Did You Hear About Us section. That's how you support us. Tell them we sent you there. And then you will receive 30 days free. So they're supporting you. You get to try it out for 30 days totally free. That's FreshBooks.com/TNW. And enter Tech News Weekly to receive 30 days free. And we thank FreshBooks for their support. In case you were looking for one more reason to turn on two-factor authentication on your accounts, it could keep weirdos from spying on your baby. Reporting for the Washington Post this week, Reed Albergati writes that anyone with an internet connection and rudimentary skills can virtually break into your house using the very tools that you bought to protect your house from those intruders. Welcome to the show, Reed.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. So tell us this story of Tara Thomas.
Well, this woman in Northern California was, has a 3-year-old daughter, and she was using her Nest Cam as kind of a baby monitor in the 3-year-old's room. And the 3-year-old kept saying, "There's a man in my room." And Tara and her husband thought their daughter was having nightmares, until one day she walked into her daughter's room and she heard, this is pretty terrible, but pornography playing through the speaker on the camera. So what had happened is somebody had logged into her account and was watching their video and also talking through using the intercom feature on the Nest Cam.
Wow. So this is sort of becoming a familiar tale. I mean, we've heard stories about, people reporting like there's a missile attack through the Nest Cam. I mean, this is a little bit too common at this point.
Exactly right. And I had seen those reports as well. And I just was really curious about exactly what was going on, because I'd sort of followed this industry for a while. In fact, I have a Nest Cam that I did use as a baby monitor, and there were never any reports of Nest Cams being breached, right? It was always some other off-brand product. And all of a sudden, there were these Nest Cam breaches. So I was really curious about why exactly that was happening. I think we got to the bottom of the issue, which is that there are so many password breaches now all over the internet, where some random website breached. In my case, I looked it up. My password on house.com had been breached. I didn't even remember that I had an account with House. And it's on the internet for anyone to download. And then the other thing that's going on is there's this software. It's called credential stuffing software that basically takes those credentials, those usernames and passwords, and stuffs them into lots of hundreds or thousands of different websites and online platforms automatically. And those credential stuffing programs have been around for a long time. But one of them, called Sniper, that I actually focused on in this article, is so easy to use. It costs $20 to download, that you don't need any experience with hacking or coding to use it. And around the time that these Nest Cam breaches were sort of in the news, Sniper happened to add, what they call a config for Nest Cam. So all of a sudden, anyone who used Sniper could just log into people's Nest accounts. It's as simple as that. And I can't prove that there's a correlation there, but it certainly seems like it. And I've talked to some security researchers who felt the same way.
Well, and you point out in your article, you would kind of, I think, been in communication with the person who created the app, and they said they'd remove they'd remove these devices from the app if the manufacturers would actually ask them to do it. Apparently that's all it takes. But I mean, is Google or is Nest, you know, in the business of contacting, you know, would-be hackers or whatever, creating software that's going to make their devices, you know, insecure and saying, please take us out of there? They're probably not going to do that, right?
No, they're not going to do that. I did ask that question. I passed that information along as sort of, in my view, a public service. And they said, you know, we've had situations like this before where they've sort of essentially tried to negotiate with hackers and it hasn't turned out well. I asked for examples and they didn't want to share those examples. This person who would not reveal his identity to me, he goes by the online handle Pragma, which I guess is short for pragmatic and also has some sort of meaning in the security research world. He's, you know, essentially a, you know, kind of a nefarious character in this whole thing because he's allowing this hacking to happen. Now, he says he's doing it to just raise awareness of security concerns. He also happens to be profiting from this. Mm-hmm. So I kind of can see both sides here. But part of the reason I talked to this person is that I just wanted to demystify this. This isn't some sort of, you know, security gap that it was found by, you know, cutting edge research. This is everyone pretty much reuses their passwords across the internet now. And it's just gotten so easy to do that people are doing it and they're, you know, not even necessarily looking to profit. They're just kind of pranking people.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in the beginning, you know, we learned years ago not to reuse passwords, but it just seems like there are so many more passwords, so many places. It's hard sometimes not to. You pointed out that Google said, well, they should have, this person should have turned on two-factor authentication. And she said, Thomas said she did turn it on. And Google said, actually, you didn't. So, I mean, you can forgive this person for not really necessarily understanding. I mean, there's a lot where there's third-party authenticators. There's, you know, two-factor through your phone. It's confusing for average people.
It is absolutely confusing. And, you know, I have tried to explain password managers where, you know, you have a one-stop shop. You keep all your passwords in one place and it allows you to use randomly generated passwords on all your different accounts. And it's really tough to explain how to use this. Those password managers need to get a lot easier to use. And really, everyone needs to use them. I mean, it's as simple as that. Right now, it's about 1% of people on the internet are using these things. And it needs to be 100% because everyone's passwords, if you go to Have I Been, I guess it's pawned or owned.com, you know, everyone's password has been stolen at some point and posted on the internet. And if you're reusing that password, you're really a sitting duck.
Now, you also point out in your article that, you know, Nest was acquired by Google and Nest's kind of approach to privacy prior to Google's acquisition kind of goes counter to Google's own, you know, approach to privacy as far as, you know, sharing lots of data. And so, in other words, like Google is very capable of securing its products, but it kind of requires a little more than what Nest was comfortable with initially. So they're protected in a different sort of way. Is it possible at this point that Nest kind of changes that tune and over secures itself? I mean, maybe they have to if stuff like this continues, or would that even address the problem?
I wouldn't use the term over secure, but
yeah,
there are some things that Nest could do that it doesn't do. Such as use CAPTCHAs. That's where,
right,
you know, you click on these. Your viewers know what CAPTCHAs are, you know, but they don't want to do that because it becomes very annoying and can actually stop some people from using the product. It creates this kind of friction. And, you know, the truth is Nest, to be fair to them, they do a lot to try to stop credential stuffing. They look for patterns. They look, you know, for suspicious logins. They look for, you know, same IP addresses being used to log into several different accounts. But, you know, that's not actually going to stop something like Sniper from working. You really need to use some of these more annoying tactics like CAPTCHAs.
And so what was Thomas's eventual solution to this problem?
she unplugged her camera and she's not going to use it again. And to be honest, I actually did the same thing. I had been using this as a baby monitor. And, you know, I feel comfortable now using security cameras pointing outside to the outside of my house, but I don't want them inside my house. I think it's too risky, even though I do use a password manager and I do use two-factor authentication anytime it's available. It just seems risky now to me. And I think, you know, that's a question more consumers should be asking themselves. Is this technology really ready yet? Should we be connecting all these devices to our home networks without really fully understanding all the risks?
Absolutely. I mean, I have cameras only pointing out as well, because I mean, our web producer has a Wyze cam, and you know, it's super cute to be able to see his baby during the day, but I didn't have that when my teenagers were little, and you know, it was fine. So I think you just have to weigh the risk. Wyze cam yesterday, I don't know if this was in response to all the news, but they turned on two-factor too. So if you have a Wyze cam, you know, make sure to set that up on your end. So let's also move on to the Apple Qualcomm story. I wanted to talk briefly with you about that as well. You were in the courtroom and covering it. Tell us a little bit about how it wrapped up.
Well, it wrapped up rather quickly. The Apple, you know, gave their opening statements first, and before Qualcomm was even done with its opening statements, the two sides settled the lawsuit. But before they settled, Qualcomm was able to, you know, put forth a bunch of new documents that had been sealed on the court record previously. They're now actually public. There was sort of a week delay there where you couldn't download them. You can now download them. But they had a bunch of slides showing these internal documents that Apple had created. And, you know, Apple had come up with a plan years ago to basically lower its licensing payments to Qualcomm. They use Qualcomm chips in their phones. And as part of that process, it's a very convoluted and complicated process, but as part of it, Apple pays a license fee for all of Qualcomm's patents at the same time. And, you know, Apple's really actually been trying to you know, change the perception of that whole industry and how people who create this technology are compensated for it.
Some of the documentation showed that Apple was planning to wait until after its contracts with Qualcomm expired before actually kind of pursuing this patent fight. I think the question that I had when I was reading that is like, okay, on one hand, that feels like bad business. Or maybe it's smart business. I don't really know. Like, maybe Apple is just, you know, doing what it felt it needed to do to satisfy its own business needs. What's your take on that?
My take is that this ultimately what it came down to was a business dispute. Apple wanted to reduce its costs, and these two sides were sort of fighting over that. And Apple's is necessary to try to change change that agreement. And that included using the courts and also, you know, working with regulators in, you know, Asia and the U.S. to try to change this dynamic between Qualcomm and really the companies that manufacture the phones. They're the ones who actually pay the license fees and buy the chips from Qualcomm. So it just to me, it kind of showed. These documents gave you a glimpse behind the scenes and showed that, you know, this ultimately comes down to trying to save money, which is ultimately, to your point, what public companies are supposed to do. They're supposed to deliver value to their shareholders and save as much money as possible. It's just that sometimes it gets framed in the public as almost this like moral fight. And I think they're, you know, there was more to it than that.
Yeah.
So will consumers see any difference as a result of this trial?
Possibly. I mean, there's talk that now Apple is going to begin using Qualcomm chips in their phones. Most consumers actually, I'd say probably pretty close to all consumers don't care what kind of wireless modem is in their phone. They just want it to work. But if there's any difference between the Qualcomm performance of Qualcomm chips and the performance of the Intel chips that Apple had been using, you know, during this dispute, then, you know, they might notice that difference. But I think it's a little murky. It's not going to change the, you know, the look and feel of the phone in any way.
Reed Albergati is the consumer electronics reporter for The Washington Post. You can see his full coverage of the Apple Qualcomm trial, the Nest Cam security, and he also talks about the Galaxy Fold at WashingtonPost.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's always fun to be on. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, Reed. We appreciate your time. All right, this week in, holy crap, AI can do that too. I bring you this. Scientists are working on ways to take brain activity and translate it into spoken words. And artificial intelligence is, of course, making it a possibility. A research team at the University of California in San Francisco created a way to decode the brain signals of research subjects using AI, machine learning, and a speech synthesizer. As with all kinds of science, it's totally imperfect at first, but it's still super impressive at this stage, and it's easy to see where it's headed, even in these early stages. I actually linked to a video, and it's queued up to listen to it immediately. Here we go.
That you're seeking is sign available in books.
So I don't know if it's possible
to play. The proof that you are seeking is not available in books.
So the second one is the actual spoken part. If you go to... There we go. The proof that you are seeking is not available in books. That's completely generated through this weird process where basically, what do they have to do? They had the UCSF scientists recorded audio from the participants who were reading the sentences out loud. They had a brain implant that was actually installed, tracking kind of their neural activity. Then they converted those sentences to the actual physical movements that the mouth makes when phrasing them, and converted that to synthetic sentences that were generated by the computer, and that's what you heard. And then, of course, they had volunteers kind of listen to be on deck to kind of identify words and phrases and kind of rate them and everything. But the idea here was that the brain, when we talk, the brain fires off signals to our mouth to move in certain ways to mouth these words that we say. And this is kind of tapping into that brain function to say, if we can kind of capture what it wants your mouth to do when you're saying these things, then we can kind of interpret what it's saying, and hence what you heard in the synthesis. It's really weird.
It's amazing. More AI like this, please. Like, that's what I want it to be used for. Because, I mean, you know, we talk for a living, and you sort of take for granted getting those ideas from your brain out into the world. And My niece has trouble communicating. She has epilepsy, which they studied with epilepsy, but epilepsy patients. But it's heartbreaking to see that, you know, she has something to say and it's not coming out. It's just, if you ever have experienced that, you just realize, like, something like this would be amazing for so many people. They said it took over a year to translate the speech, so we're not necessarily close to this.
No.
But I like where it's going.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I think I read it's probably like a decade out from even clinical tests, but this is super early stages. But yeah, my grandma, when she was alive, she had a stroke, and for like the last 7 years of her life had a really hard time talking. And you can see in someone's, I could see in her face how kind of the frustration of, like, she knows exactly what she wanted to say in that moment, but she just get really frustrated because her mouth wouldn't allow her to do it the way it used to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this is a future I can get down with, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think it's awesome research, and I don't know, it's a good utilization of the power of AI.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you. Did you know that the TV show The Office represented 3% of Netflix total U.S. viewing last year?
Wow. Are you part of that 3%?
We watched a few episodes. I've seen them all, but I don't rewatch them regularly. Yeah. According to Vice, there's a very healthy Reddit community devoted to meeting other people who fall asleep watching The Office every night. Like, okay. That's a thing.
Well,
like, those people
Reddit.
Do. And friend of the show, Micah Sargent, he has a podcast dedicated to rewatching The Office. It is a very popular show, but I didn't know 3% of all U.S. viewing last year was The Office. That's crazy. And yet, NBC is threatening to take back the streaming rights to the show from Netflix. So it could only be shown on the NBC Universal app. They might also take back Parks and Rec and Friends.
Yeah.
Thoughts on this?
Big surprise. I mean, this is like this is the direction that things seem to be going with streaming right now. And if we're not seeing it, the effects of it immediately, I think over the course of the next couple of years, we're going to see a lot more of this. Disney, of course, mm-hmm. they're creating their own streaming app. And of course, Disney has an insane library, so they have the library to support it. But I think once that happens, I've heard that content's going to be removed from Netflix. And I think it's just, you know, stuff like this is a big reason why Netflix is going so crazy for creating its own content mm-hmm. because it's, you know, it's kind of like become its own network in a sense. You know, so much of what you find on there is its own content. This other stuff fills in the gaps and everything. But yeah, I think there's a whole lot more of this to come. It seems like everything's being siloed out into the creator's own streaming apps. And at the end of the day, we're going to be paying a whole lot more than we paid just watching stuff on satellite or cable or whatever.
I think so too. We had a little Twitter conversation about this yesterday. Like I still enjoy Stranger Things. You got bored in the second season.
I got kind of bored with it. Yeah. I'm kind of ashamed to admit it because I loved the first season, but I just, for whatever reason, kind of fell off on the second season and I didn't have that light. To like move me to the end. No, I didn't finish it.
So I think that's the only, I do like it. The second season wasn't as good as the first season, but I'm not watching any other original content on Netflix. There's nothing else that I'm at all interested in.
Yeah, I hop in and out. There's a couple of them, you know, because there's so few and far between. So it can be, there's one called Love that I thought was really good. Mm. There was another one, Friends. I can't even remember the name of it. See, and this is kind of part of the problem too, is that Netflix creates so much original content mm-hmm. that sometimes I'll see like a poster for something or an ad for something. I'll be like, oh, when is that in the theater? Oh, that's on Netflix. I've never even heard of that. And that's been on Netflix for 2 months. Like, there's so much there that it gets lost. It's almost like that's its strength and its weakness mm-hmm. because people would value it a little bit more if they knew that some of this really great content is there hiding in plain sight.
Right.
You know?
Lost in Space was good too. I watched that on Netflix.
I didn't watch that. I remember when that released and it looked interesting, but I didn't.
But there's
Black Mirror, of course.
Yeah. Burke's saying Altered Carbon. I've never seen that.
I started Altered Carbon and I couldn't get but maybe three episodes into that. It just kind of lost myself on that one.
But I don't think Netflix, I could give up Netflix right now.
Yeah.
I would be okay with it because I have Hulu and I have HBO and Amazon Prime and all my favorite shows are on those.
Until they're not anymore.
Hulu. Hulu isn't.
Hulu's different. Hulu's kind of
HBO.
Like, yeah.
Those are HBO shows, and I won't stop paying for HBO because. Totally. So it's totally. And The Good Place. I guess I do watch that on Netflix because I don't. And I watch that on Hulu. Yeah. Who knows? I'm done talking about TV. It's like my second job sometimes. There's so much to do. And if I had to give up Netflix, I think I'd be okay with it.
Yeah. Sounds like you've got a lot of other things to fill in the gaps.
A lot of other TV to watch, yes.
I wish I had. God, I don't know how you find the time to watch all that TV. I don't even know where I fit
my
in.
My kids don't pay any attention to me anymore because they're teenagers.
Oh, okay. That helps. Mm-hmm. That helps. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. If your kids aren't paying attention to you anymore, you might as well watch us there live, maybe all day, even 7 days a week. You can do it, twit.tv/live. And you can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNW. We're here for you, empty nesters. Even if your kids haven't moved out, they still live there. They're watching their own Netflix upstairs. Also, follow us on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and you can tweet at me. Tweet at me some of the shows that you like on Netflix or whatever. I want to hear about them because all the shows that I've watched recently, I got recommended to from people on Twitter. So I'm at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps us out. Thanks to Burke, who looks a little bored right now, but that's okay. Thanks to Jammer B, who's pacing in the studio. Thanks. You kind of see him in the darkness right over there. And thanks to you guys for watching. We appreciate it. And we'll see you next week on another episode. Oh, I'm sorry. There's Alex. No. Bye. All right. We'll see you next week on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.